Good morning. Welcome to our study this morning. I'm going to be finished for a while with Nehemiah. We've been studying him for quite a bit. I think I've covered the biggest part of that book, and I might have another lesson in the future to come back if I have another one from him, but I'm going to move on to some other things now. I appreciate your kind attention. Somebody told me if you're going to do a series, it needs to be seven or less. I don't know. I was afraid to go back and count how many lessons I've done from Nehemiah, but probably more. I don't know. Anyway, but I hope that was helpful to you. A few weeks before we studied Nehemiah, I did a lesson on a Sunday about Sarah. I've been reading the story of Abraham, so we did our TV show, and Sarah stood out to me as somebody I hadn't thought about a lot. And I went back through that story of Sarah and Abraham and realized that she, in the New Testament, was given as the model of a wife who was in submission. She kind of held up as a model. So I did a lesson that one Sunday on her as in her life as a role model for ladies who had that role of submission. And then later somebody said, well, you need to balance that out. There's another side, and that is, there's the fellas who need to be leaders. And so I thought, well, I wanted to take some time and for us to think about the challenge. If there's a challenge to being submissive, and that certainly is a challenge, there's also a challenge to being good leaders. And so I want us to look at the role of leadership, and I'm going to use Jesus as the model. Because certainly he would have been the greatest leader for us, the one who shows us what leadership is. He's the ideal that we reach up to and seek to attain his perfection. And so we're going to look at him in a few minutes. But I did put down, first of all, some various forms of leadership people try. And that's pretty common. You might observe some of these different levels. Maybe in business, sometime you observe these. Sometime in congregations with elders. Sometimes in families with fathers. So there's different kinds of ways people approach leadership. Democratic form, where you take a vote and see what everybody wants, and then you do what the majority says. There's the passive leader that's sort of undetectable. You don't really know he is a leader. Sometimes women are sometimes tempted to take the leadership role because their husbands don't have much of a leadership role in the family. And sometimes the fearful leader, one who's insecure, he's kind of afraid to make decisions. He doesn't want to displease others. No courage to say that we're going to serve the Lord. He's afraid of what might be said back or to stand before those who disagree and defend the Lord's name. That would be Saul, maybe, in the Old Testament. He was a fearful leader. Silent leader that offers no counsel at all to the kids or to the wife or never tells them what he's doing. The insensitive leader, sometimes he hurts other people in the things he does. Doesn't think about those who are following him. He can't understand why they're having such a hard time. Lot's a good example of that. He went to Sodom and lived there. He may have been a righteous man. He may have resisted Sodom, but he was completely insensitive to what was going on with his family. It's his wife and children ended up being lost in that enterprise, lacked the insight into the needs of others. Then there's explosive leadership, the guy that's always irritable, always flying off the handle, always nervous, ready to fight. You have to walk on eggshells around him all the time. That's a form of leadership. People lead that way. And also the dictator, he's kind of tyrannical. He dominates the family or the business sometimes. Or the elder that just, strong arms the congregation. He tells everybody what to do. He's jealous of his position. He's protective of it. He's like Herod that killed the babies because he was just afraid somebody was going to threaten and challenge his position. So he's very controlling, micromanages everything. All of these are, you can observe these things. Maybe everybody's had some experience, maybe whether it's in business and seeing somebody run a company and using these forms, or maybe even a congregation, you may see elders that would use some of these forms, or in a family, maybe as a father or a husband. Reasons people choose to lead these ways. different. Sometimes it's by default. Sometimes it's what you learn. So you grow up, and that's what you learn from your own father. Or maybe you learn that from seeing previous owners of businesses. That's how they operated their business. I think that's how it's supposed to be done. Or maybe elders. You elder a certain way, shepherd a certain way, because that's how you've seen it done in the past. Sometimes it's kind of a default mechanism. You just fall into that. Other times it's because, you know, when we're spiritually weak. Sometimes we know these aren't the best forms, the best ways to lead, but when we're not doing well spiritually, we sort of fall into the trap and practice these sometimes because it's just where we are. Other times it's because it's kind of pragmatic. You know, it works. I get results from this. And so therefore we choose those methods because they seem to work for us. Most of us can see the flaws in these methods. It's not too hard. We know they're not the best way to lead. What's more important to see that they're not the best way is that God is to understand that not all forms of leadership are acceptable to God. Just one example in the Old Testament, he addressed the shepherds of Israel during a particular period of their existence, and they were the leaders, and he says to them through Ezekiel, "Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds. Prophesy and say to those shepherds, thus saith the Lord God, woe, shepherds of Israel, who've been feeding themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flock? You eat the fat, clothe yourselves with wool, you slaughter the fat sheep without feeding the flock. Those who are sickly, you've not strengthened. The distressed, you haven't healed. Broken, you haven't bound up. Scattered, you've not brought back. Nor have you sought for the lost, but with force and with severity you dominated them." Bad leadership. The history of Israel was laden with it. That doesn't mean they were all bad leaders. I mean, we can look at Nehemiah. He was a good leader. Moses was a good leader, held up as a good leader. Joshua was a good leader of Israel. Hezekiah was. But, you know, by and large, Israel had bad shepherds. And about 99.9% of the reason, because they had bad character. They chose people who reflected their character. And so they had bad experiences with these leaders. But the point is here is that God doesn't accept any form of leadership. And just like in that day, Jesus condemned the Jewish leaders of his day. They were abusive to the people. They were selfish. They were jealous. They killed him because he was going to take over their leadership, take their leadership away from the people. So they killed him. So you can decide to lead in one of those forms. But God has something to say about it. You can't choose that one of these forms of leadership and when we not pay the consequences. We have to answer to God for the way we choose to lead. And so we could talk about that a lot, talk about bad leadership. But I would like for us to spend our time discussing good leadership instead and focus on the positive. And I had a book that I got a quote out of a while back. Carl Sandburg wrote a big book about Abraham Lincoln. And one of the things, the book I have is called A Man of Steel and Velvet by Aubrey Andelin. But he quoted Carl Sandburg on Abraham Lincoln. And he said, "Not often in the story of mankind does a man arrive on the earth who is both steel and velvet, who is hard as a rock and soft as drifting fog, who holds in his heart and mind the paradox of terrible storm and peace unspeakable and perfect." Makes you want to read about Lincoln, learn a little bit more about him. He'd be a good study, maybe, in some of the qualities of leadership. He was referring to Lincoln's strong qualities, qualities of integrity and honesty and courage under fire, and then his softer qualities of compassion and friendliness and his love for others. And you know, we could study Lincoln, but I think I'd far rather study about Jesus. And he certainly reflected the perfect balance of these qualities of both steel and velvet. He was a man of steel. He was hard as steel, unbreakable, strong and courageous and permanent. And yet he was also soft and beautiful and comfortable as velvet. Just working with that idea, that contrast of these two types of material, I want us to think about the leadership of Jesus a little bit as a model for us. And first of all, he's a man of steel. He had determination and focus. Jesus had a lot of determination and focus. He set his face toward Jerusalem. Luke chapter 9 and verse 51, he set his face resolutely. I like that verse. And this was before the end. It says it came about when the days were approaching for his ascension that he resolutely set his face to go to Jerusalem. He had a focus. He had a task to accomplish. And he wouldn't be deterred from what he was given to do. Even when he was confronted by it, he tried to tell his apostles about it. Matthew chapter 16. Explained to them that he had to go up to Jerusalem and be arrested and killed and raised on the third day. And of course, Peter couldn't understand that. And he said, you know, far be it from you, you know, Lord, that it's going to happen. And he had to rebuke him. He said, get behind me, Satan. Because your interests are not our man's and not those of God. Peter didn't understand, but Jesus kept his focus and his determination in spite of even his apostles who didn't understand what he was doing. He wouldn't be deterred from what his plan was. He went to Jerusalem and he went there to die. That's what he had been given. And that's a quality of the leader. He has focus and determination. He had courage to go against the accepted norms. Jesus, you know, said to people, you know, he said, you've heard it said, but I say unto you. They had standards that they were comfortable with. They liked them. They were conservative standards, and they were comfortable. And Jesus came in and he says, we're going to go beyond that. I'm raising the bar. And those are not adequate. You're going to have to do better than that. And so to the religious conservatives of his day, Jesus said many things in Matthew chapter 5, just, you know, a sample. You've heard it said that you should not commit murder. But I say to you that everybody who's angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Or he said in verse 27, Matthew 5, you've heard it said that you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery in his heart. Or verse 33, you've heard it said that you shall not make false vows, but fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it's the throne of God, or earth, for it's the footstool of his feet. Or verse 38, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say, don't resist whom is evil, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, then turn him the other also. Jesus raises the bar. He pushed the standards to a higher level, and those things didn't go over well. He was more conservative than the conservative right. Are we? I'm not going to get off on that sidetrack. But are we, is that the best we have? Are we just as conservative as the conservative right America? Or is our culture the standard, or is Jesus the standard? You know, he was a man of steel. He went beyond the standards that were acceptable and pushed people further. He was not afraid to face the hardness of his opponents. They challenged him. Matthew chapter 21, verse 23. It's not coming through clear, is it? I don't know what happened. Matthew chapter 21, 23. In the last week when he was in the temple. He came to the temple, the chief priests and the elders said, by what authority are you doing these things? He said, since when do you care about authority? He said, what about John the Baptist? Was he from heaven or men? And they said, well, they had to think about that. Because if they had said from heaven, he would say, well, why don't you obey him? If they had said from men, then they feared the people. So it was a political question to them. So they said, well, we don't know. You know? But when he wasn't afraid to face his opponents when they charged him and challenged him. He said, you know, since when do you care about authority? He was zealous for God's will and willing to rebuke sin. He turned over the tables, turned over the money changers, turned the money changers out of the temple, chapter 21, verse 12 and 13. He overturned the tables. He said to them, it's written, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you're making it a robber's den. He is very zealous for God's will. And he wasn't afraid to face people who were abusing God's house and changing things. He rebukes him. So I'm just saying, these are the qualities of steel. This is a man that you recognize as someone who has courage and has determination and focus. And he's not a compromiser. These are steel qualities in a leader. He also protected and defended the helpless. You know, he took special interest in those who were despised, those who were considered the worthless of society. Those who didn't measure up, the children and the lepers and sometimes the women who were looked down upon, Jesus associated with them. He didn't see that as being a worthy attribute to stay back and keep an arm's distance away from those people. He rebuked people who for not treating them properly. He told the, you know, when the woman washed his feet with the alabaster vial of perfume and the disciples were grumbling, he said, "You let her alone. She's doing a good work for me." Or when the children were brought to him, the disciples were trying to run him off, he said, "Don't forbid the children to come. The kingdom's made of them." You know, Jesus protected those who were the defenseless. It's a quality of steel. He committed no sin. No deceit was found in his mouth. He was blameless in his character. He was put in situations where he could have compromised and said things that were ugly, but he stayed with the pattern of behavior that God had laid out for him. He was blameless in his character, and he was controlled. This kind of goes with that. He didn't revile in return. He uttered no threats. How many times are we guilty of that? You know, how many times do we respond back out of emotions instead of being principle-driven men? But he was a master of himself. Under pressure, he stood firm. To Pilate, he didn't even say anything back. Didn't even answer. Didn't even need to answer back. On the cross, when other people abused him, he didn't sling mud in return. Mud slinging. How many times does that go back and forth in sometimes religious papers, and somehow that's honorable? It's dishonorable. It's people that don't know how to control themselves. But he didn't ever do that. He was controlled and principle-driven. And he was willing to sacrifice himself for the benefit of others. I lay down my life for the sheep. Jesus was a man of steel. And and these qualities, we look at and we admire those kind of qualities in a person because they inspire confidence in others. They draw people to want to follow you when you have that kind of character, to be like them. They cause people to trust in them when they have these qualities of steel. But you know, those qualities alone, if that's all there, a lot of men that have qualities of steel, but if you just have that raw side, it can be very intimidating. Somebody painted it like a picture of, I should have had some kind of picture of some beautiful architectural building that was made out of steel and had a great structure within it that fortified it and made it great resistant to any kind of weather or whatever. But the architectural that was, they fine-tune it with all kind of decorations and things on the outside that make it look beautiful, make it look attractive. Jesus wasn't merely a man of steel, he was also a man of velvet. He had these other qualities that balanced him out. He was gentle, he was tender, kind, generous, patient, had humility. The women and children were drawn to him. He drew people that otherwise would have been intimidated by him. He was compassionate. He fed the multitudes. He touched the lepers. He healed the blind. He showed compassion to people. Loved them. The ones that many people despised and didn't care about. He continued to work with his apostles though they were frustrating at times. He was very patient. All these apostles were men he could have said, you're not worth me wasting my time with. I tried you. You're wasting my time. I'm going to go find some better guys. But he stayed with these guys 3 years. And kept working with them. And he was frustrated sometimes. He wasn't, but he didn't give up on these people. He showed the quality of patience as he worked with these men. He washed the feet of the apostles. Humility. The King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. He has all this great power. On the other side, he has this, it's interesting. The book of Mark paints Jesus in the first 8 chapters as a man with great power and authority, greater than any of the rulers of the synagogues and such. But then the second half of the book of Mark paints him as a man that was very humble and was a servant of others. And of course, in the book of John, he even washes the apostles' feet. So you see this man who had humility. He did humiliating things, things that would have been looked down upon if you were somebody that was climbing the ladder of success or you were going to be somebody in society. He did things that were not acceptable for a person who was trying to campaign for some kind of great position. Jesus wasn't campaigning. He wept when Lazarus died, John chapter 11. He wept with those who wept. It was a quality that made him personable. It was a quality that drew people to him. He was tempted in all the points that we have, and yet without sin. He was sympathetic. He's a great high priest to us because he's been tempted like we are. He can sympathize with the things that we have to go through. He was made like us so that he could, you know, and that draws people to him. You know, these qualities of velvet, they make people. It creates comfort, creates security. And it causes people to think that he can relate to me. He knows what I'm going through. And when we were sinners, Christ died for us. He loved us in spite of our sin. You know, sometimes somebody does something against another, and they never let you forget. They hate you. They won't speak to you. Won't even give you the time of day. But the Lord, who we have sinned against, yet while we were sinners, says that Christ died for us. Again, you know, those qualities of steel that we mentioned, they inspire confidence in others, they draw people to want to follow you, and yet the qualities of velvet, they draw us too. They make us feel loved, they make us feel cherished, safe, cared for. Jesus possessed both of those, had the perfect balance of steel and velvet. You know, the best time for us to start training in these qualities into ourselves is probably when we're young, especially for fathers and we have children, train them into children when they're young. But the good news is, I think it's still possible even when we're older, when we're men, and because you know these apostles, they had learned the world's methods, they had learned leadership from their Jewish leaders, they had learned the world's methods of leadership, and yet when they came in contact with Jesus, while it was harder perhaps to unlearn those things, if you've already learned the ways, Jesus helped them to unlearn their worldly ways and to reshape them, and that can happen for us too. We can be reshaped into better leaders. I only say that because when we look at the model of Jesus, we just kind of shake our heads and say, "Man, that's impossible." I mean, there's no hope for me. You know, when I look at those qualities of Jesus of steel and velvet, I think, "How in the world am I ever going to have that kind of character?" But it's you know, that's not true. It's a matter of the heart. It's a matter of the will that wants to change and sets their mind to do it, and it's about God's power and His grace who makes the impossible become possible. But that's what He sets before us is the ideal. And we're supposed to be idealists. We're supposed to not be content with where we are, but reach ahead. Well, what model did Jesus follow? Did He follow any of those forms of leadership? Did He appeal to the democratic model? Is that what He did? Did He put everything to a vote? Was he passive leader, the leadership that was, you know, undetectable? Was He fearful or silent or insensitive? Was He explosive? Was He a dictator? Did he micromanage and control everybody and force them to do it exactly like He did? No, He called people to follow Him. The way that He is presented in the Bible, it seemed to me, He was portrayed as a shepherd. He had a shepherd form. I'm the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. That's how Jesus is portrayed as a leader. Calling people to follow Him. People followed His voice. Willingly, voluntarily. He sacrificed Himself for people, and that drew them to Him, to want to follow Him. He was a servant. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give His life as a ransom for many. Presented that as the a picture of a leader. Usually you don't think of a servant as a leader. Usually the servant is a person who's beneath everybody. You know, he's the guy that doesn't go before people. He's a person that scrubs the floors and washes the toilets and whatever. And the leader is the guy who just tells everybody what to do. And he sits in an ivory tower and looks down on everybody. But Jesus was the servant. That's the model He has. He was the guy who was on the floor washing the feet. He was the very antithesis of what we admire in leadership. Or what the world, I'll say, admires in leadership. And he was a steward. You know, I'd never thought about this stewardship, but God gave people into His hands, put people into His hands. I've never read the prayer in John 17. You ought to read that completely as you think about Jesus as a leader. But it's interesting to see how it works out. You know, While I was with them, I was keeping them in your name, which you have given me, and guarded them, and not one of them perished, but the son of perdition. You know, I was keeping them, I was guarding them. And the whole prayer is about these people that God had put into his hands, and he'd cared for, and equipped, and taught, and worked with, and he had been a good steward of the possession that God had given him. Isn't that interesting? You know, material things are so worthless. And what God cares about is people. And so he put into Jesus' hands people to care for. And that's what stewardship is about. It's about caring for people. And when we talk about leadership. And we don't have time to talk a lot about all of these different pictures of Jesus. That's a good study maybe that you can do on your own. But I did want to spend the last couple of minutes just giving you some practical applications for husbands and fathers and elders. Put those three up there as our models for leadership. I read an article a few years ago that a fellow did. His name was Bill Hall, and it was called Good Leadership. So, or it was asked the question, what is good leadership? So I modified it just a little bit because I wanted to form it more in the shape of, what is a good husband? What is a good father? What are good elders? What are leadership qualities that would characterize men who would, you know, be good leaders? And so that's kind of where I borrowed the idea, but I thought he said things very well. He said they have vision to see what needs to be done. They look at the end. They keep the end in mind and work toward that end as they build people. They move forward. They're positive in their approach. They stir confidence in others and convince them that the impossible task can be accomplished. A father does that. A husband does that for his wife. An elder does that for a congregation. He moves them forward. He's positive. He says, we can do this. This looks impossible, but it can be done because Jesus Christ is capable of accomplishing things that are impossible in our lives. Good leadership, husbands, fathers, and elders have faith in people. They show confidence in others. And they believe that others want to work and that they will respond when properly challenged. They place the best possible construction on the actions of others. Good leadership, you know, they believe in people and they know people want to do well. They believe in them, show confidence in them, and challenge them to be the best. You know, it's really sad sometimes when fathers will say to their kids, "You're never going to amount to anything." You ever heard guys say things like that to their kids? You're worthless, you know, or say things that communicate that idea to their children. You know, that's not inspiring faith, not inspiring confidence in somebody who would like to be better. They believe, they show confidence. You know, I always think about Jesus and what he could have said to his apostles. What he could have said to Peter, Andrew, James, and John, all of the times that they disappointed him. And they disappointed him a lot of times. And did some really dumb things. And he did rebuke them. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he didn't berate them in a way that destroyed their confidence and their ability to move forward. He showed confidence in them. Good leadership bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things, because good leadership loves. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and the verses that come from that. They don't run ahead of others. Good leadership doesn't run ahead of others. In fact, they don't do everything themselves. They frequently step aside and wait, sometimes anxiously, while other people get the chance to do the task that they themselves probably could do better. You know, a lot of times fathers or husbands or elders can do things really well, but they are trying to create leadership in others, and so they give others the opportunity to do. And I think about the application of that in the Bible as Jesus sent his 12 apostles out two by two to go out and teach. They didn't know a lot. In fact, he'll get on to them many times after that for their proudness or their carnal ideas about the kingdom and such. But he still sent them out two by two. And he told them what to say. And he said, you go out and do this. You go out and try it out. You know, he was training them. He showed confidence in them. He He could have done it better himself, far better than they could have done it. But he waited and gave them a chance to perform the task that they were capable of. And he still does that. You know, Jesus could still be here. He could have said, you know, this is a very important work. I can't leave that up to a bunch of, you know, bumps on a log or nincompoops or whatever kind of words you want to use, because these guys will mess everything up. But interestingly, you know, when you get to Ephesians chapter 4 and he talks about the body of Christ, he says that he gave some as apostles and prophets and some as evangelists and pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of service to the building up of the body of Christ until we all attain the unity of the faith, the knowledge of God, to a mature man. He had confidence in his body. He put it in the hands of individuals. Equip men to go and equip others. And so I think that's a neat application of good leadership. Jesus sets before us as he gives tasks to others to perform. Again, they are not nearly so, husbands, fathers, and elders are not nearly so concerned with getting things done as they are with developing people into useful, mature servants of the Lord. That's a good statement. What are we trying to achieve? Just get the job done or develop people into mature servants of the Lord. Good leadership is constantly producing leadership in others. They have a real concern for others. They have the ability to communicate that concern. They are patient, understanding. They're neither too quick to rebuke, nor are they too indulgent towards sin. Really easy to rebuke with harshness when somebody does something wrong. I'm far too quick to be critical, hypercritical, expect, you know, somebody to never have made this mistake, and once I correct them once, they should never do it again. And why would they ever do it again if I've already corrected them once? You know, it's so impatient. How many times did Jesus correct his apostles for their mistakes? There, he was patient, understanding, not too quick to rebuke, but neither indulgent of sin. That would be what husbands and fathers and elders work towards, developing those kind of qualities. They place themselves in the other man's position to see things from his viewpoint. Can I get on the other side? Can I understand why that person's being that way? Can I understand that before I address it? Maybe seeing it from their perspective. Maybe they're wrong, but at least I can see why they're doing what they're doing. And then maybe I can think the most effective way to help them grow from that standpoint. Or maybe they are right and I just haven't gotten into their shoes to understand what they're doing. Good leadership is humble. It's willing to acknowledge mistakes. It can accept criticism and separate the constructive from the destructive. It's probably one of the places that we, of course, separate ourselves from Jesus, because he never made mistakes. He never needed corrected. He was perfect and flawless in all that he did, but we're not. And good leadership learns to grow, recognizes that it has room to grow, and even when somebody corrects him and we don't do it the most perfect way, he's ready to listen and find what's good in it so that he can grow in his development as a leader. And good leadership seeks the praise of God rather than the praise of men. It sacrifices popularity to do God's will. Good leadership is going to take people to heaven, wants to lead people to heaven. He's not always going to find everybody applauding his efforts. That not everybody's going to hug his neck and say, "Oh, I'm so glad that you told us we couldn't do that." In fact, he's probably going to get the opposite reaction many times. But that's not what he's there for, is to get that applause. He's there to help people to go to heaven. So he sacrifices popularity to do God's will. He has conviction. Husbands, fathers, leaders, they have conviction, but they're not stubborn. They're not headstrong. They listen to others and they view their ideas objectively. They treat all people alike. They're impartial. They don't treat one child better than the other child. They don't elevate one person. An elder doesn't elevate one person in the congregation above another person. He sees them all as equals and equally valuable. Good leadership is frank and candid, but it's kind. It has to call sin, sin, but it doesn't have to destroy somebody and be harsh and ripping to accomplish his purpose. Frank and candidness, but kindness are incredible balances and qualities. Good leadership is self-confident, but not proud. It doesn't have to be self-promoting. It's not, look at me, look at all that I'm doing. Does anybody want to congratulate me? That's not what leaders do. They are self-confident, but they're not proud. They don't promote themselves before others. So I go back to our beginning scripture as we conclude this morning. Jesus became the model for husbands as He is the leader that we needed to go before us to show us what we need to be in our families. Love your wives just like Christ loved the church. He gave Himself for her. He sacrificed Himself so that He might set her apart, cleanse her, that He might present to Himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing. But notice how everything He does is for the benefit of another. It's not self, but it's about what He could do to help us, that she would be holy and blameless. He has a goal for us, and He works toward that goal. That's what His end is, that we'll be holy and blameless. So husbands also ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it as Christ does the church, because we are members of His body. So, there are some things to think about. I don't know, I'm kind of out of time now. But we need a model to follow, and we need an ideal. And if there is, God created order in the family and gave wives the role of submission, He also gave the man the role of leadership, and that's a leadership that God defines for us and tells us what kind of leadership it has to be, if it's going to be a leadership that's acceptable to Him. And so we grow and we work toward the end of bringing glory to Christ in our leadership as husbands and fathers and elders in a church. If you want to get your songbook and turn to number 287, the song that we're going to sing in a minute, I think, is Fountain Free, an opportunity for people who have never committed their lives to Christ to recognize that there's a fountain, as Isaiah put it in the passage that we studied the other week, a fountain flowing full of salvation. God has salvation by the bucket loads, and He wants us to take advantage of that. He's provided for us this well of blessings, spiritual blessings. But to respond to that is a challenge that you have if you're not a Christian, to come forward, to make Him your Lord, and to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins while we stand and sing our song.